It's an eternal tribute to democracy. It's a controversial presence in the sacred Black Hills, and it is a massive work of public art. Let's talk about Mount Rushmore. Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Thursday, January 8th. Mount Rushmore National Memorial attracts more than 2.4 million visitors each year. But before it was an international icon, it was a quieter place where families gathered for picnics on Mother's Day. A new book by journalist Matthew Davis explores the making and meaning of the public sculpture. The book is called A Biography of a Mountain. And I sat down with Matthew Davis when he was in the Black Hills for the book's launch.
Yeah, I'd spent a lot of my younger years overseas. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Mongolia and a Fulbright Fellow to the Middle East, and started an international literary center at George Mason University. And because of all that work and experience, I tended to write about and learn from writers and other people from across the world. And, you know, what ended up happening was that I had a couple sons, one in 2017 and another in 2020, on June 3rd, 2020. And it was during that summer when, you know, there was so much going on in the United States, from the pandemic to these protests over Black Lives Matter and the memorials and monuments that are being built to commemorate American history, that I really began to want to think about how to write about the United States. And on July 3rd, 2020, as many of you know here in the state of South Dakota, Donald Trump, the president at the time, appeared at Mount Rushmore. There were fireworks at the memorial for the first time in over 10 years, and he gave a speech there that was, in my view, kind of a narrow vision of American history and the memorials and monuments that were being built to commemorate it. And, you know, when I read about that speech, I began to wonder why he gave that speech at Mount Rushmore, and so I began to learn more about Rushmore, and my attention slowly became to become more focused on the United States instead of the international issues that I was concerned about beforehand.
So when you say he gave a narrow speech, remind people who have forgotten that speech what his vision of America was, because he was very much, it was a turning point during the pandemic. It was a turning point in Governor Kristi Noem's career. And I would argue it was a turning point for President Trump as well, to say this monument behind me stands for something. Here it is. What did you see as his vision in that speech that he was trying to lay out for the American people and for the world?
Well, I mean, if you recall, I mean, the context of when he gave that speech is important, because there was that summer a lot of conversation about, especially from Confederate memorials down south in the American South that were being toppled, that were being, you know, torn and being reconsidered, that those histories that were being told through those memorials and monuments did not reflect a real diverse history of the United States. And so there was a real sort of conversation we were having about all the different forms of history, all different kinds of people that have created history and made history in this country. And that was something that was very much in the conversation in the early part of the summer 2020. And so when Donald Trump spoke at Mount Rushmore, he kind of gave this, this speech that was, those histories should not be foregrounded. What should be foregrounded is the history that many of us were taught in grade school or high school, that, you know, the United States has achieved a great deal. The United States has always been on the side of the good, that we have a manifest destiny to expand our country, to be able to do the kinds of things that we have historically done and will continue to do so. And if, you know, there are roadblocks in that way, those are just roadblocks, not things that we should consider in terms of larger histories. And so I think, you know, that was the context that I was reading with his speech. And I think the other element about it, too, was it wasn't so much that that was one version of history. It was also that those that disagreed with that version of history were sort of radical leftists, the terminology that he uses quite frequently today, and people that should not be trusted with this, you know, beautiful American vision. And so I think that was the other element of it too. It wasn't so much that there was a specific history that was being told, which there was, in my opinion, but also that the response, the opposite view, was in no way being embraced or in no way being endorsed or in no way even being considered.
Mm. Did you know there were protests when you were watching the speech? Did you have an understanding of the protests and the attempts to keep the attention away from the president's rally and on to those protests?
You know, I did not watch the speech live. I was I think I read about this in the book, that my younger son was a month old, and so I was in the backyard of my home in Washington, D.C. with my wife and two kids, just trying to get a moment of peace. So I did not know that they were going on that day. When I read about the speech and I read about the protests, that's when I read about what it was happening at the base of Mount Rushmore, and you know, became very intrigued by that juxtaposition between a speech that was given at Mount Rushmore by Donald Trump, and then, you know, literally like a counter rally that was taking place with the different ideas behind what Mount Rushmore means, but also what American history means, and the different histories that people across this country have.
When did you know it was a book-length work, that it was not just the history of the mountain, but it was the biography of the mountain and really a look at what it means for us today? Like, at what point did you realize that you had a book-length work on your hands?
I think when I began to do a much deeper dive into the memorial in terms of course, where it is, but why it was there, who sculpted it. And I think, you know, foundationally for me, what was so important was to understand that so many of our American myths are sort of wrapped up in Mount Rushmore, whether that's our westward push across the continent, whether it's our really fraught relationship with Native communities, our search for gold, these big, huge, creative, ambitious projects that we engage with as a country, the sort of key words that make us American, liberty, democracy, freedom, all of that is wrapped into Mount Rushmore. And it just allowed me a real way to enter into these larger conversations with this piece of Americana, this great sculpture, which it is a beautiful sculpture in many ways, in the center of the Black Hills.
For people that you talk to around here, versus the people that you talk to about the book when maybe you're on an airplane or you're in London or you're in another larger city, are you noticing a big difference between what our intimate relationship is with the mountain versus what the rest of the nation sees and thinks of as Mount Rushmore?
You know, Lori, I do, and maybe I can just even take that and spin that a little bit, because I think this is something I have really come to terms with as I've been writing this book, is there is a real emotional attachment that people in this, and I'm talking to you from Rapid City, so there's a real emotional attachment that people in South Dakota, that especially people in the western half of South Dakota, have to Mount Rushmore. And when I mean emotional, I don't necessarily mean how they feel about it. I mean their very deep familial relationships with this area, and not just the sculpture itself. And that is, I think, really impacting and charging how people feel about the memorial in ways that, you know, my friends in Washington, D.C., or my family in Chicago, or other places across the country or the world do not have. And it's that emotional complexity that I think is what makes it so compelling as an outsider. I mean, I had no real relationship with South Dakota before I started this project. I was not related to anyone from South Dakota. I'm not Native American. And so for me, as an outsider, what I quickly learned was that it was hard not to be in Rapid City, even for one generation, and not be affected by the deep history of the Black Hills that really brought Mount Rushmore to the Black Hills.
Even the simple idea of, you know, a Mother's Day picnic before the modernization of the amphitheater and the bookstore and all of that. So not just the treaty relationships and what the Black Hills is to Native people and to the Ochechi Shakowin, but this idea that a lot of people just went and had, you know, a picnic on Mother's Day.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, was something that I learned through writing this, is that big construction project that you're referring to that was, you know, overseen by the former superintendent, Dan Wank. I mean, that had a real change in how people viewed the memorial. I mean, before, I kind of wish I could have seen the memorial before the construction, because from how it's been described to me, it was sort of like you're walking in the woods and sort of here's this sculpture, and now it's become a much sort of different experience, you know, for better and for worse, many people would probably say. But I think, you know, the way that people have ties to it changed when that construction happened. And that is part of what I'm seeking to do a little bit in this book, is to sort of ask these questions of how the meanings of memorials change over the years, because they're not static, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just because monuments and memorials, or even Mount Rushmore, which is carved into granite, those are really solid concrete materials. But the meanings behind them evolve and change as our understanding of history changes, as our understanding of why and when these memorials were built changes as well.
Yeah. And even the transition from being able to hike to the top of it, to sit on top of George Washington's head, which there are, you know, a number of people who were able to do that in a different time, and how quickly that shifted in the modern era of terrorism and public protests. And talk about how that kind of, you know, closeness, the ability to get close to the sculpture, and how that has changed over time, and what that means for this idea of, you know, patriotic national significance of the mountain.
Well, it certainly has changed. I mean, I was in Las Vegas just the other day doing an event there, and someone in the audience talked to me afterwards about how he had done a lot of geologic work on Mount Rushmore, on Crazy Horse, and on Stone Mountain Memorial down in Atlanta. Mm. And he was telling me that he was, you know, dangling from the head of George Washington, as as you were telling me. And I was like, man, I wish I could have done that. That would have been super cool and given me a much different perspective on it, potentially. But yeah, those times are gone. And as you said, I mean, a lot of it is security related. A lot of it is, you know, concern about people protesting on top of the memorial, people potentially damaging the memorial. And I totally understand that. And I think that there's, you know, that's just the reality of the way. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. It's hard to believe, but before 9/11, you could drive a car right by the White House, right? Yeah. And I think that that's just the nature of how our relationship to security changes over the years. And, you know, without having been to the memorial before it is now, in terms of you not being able to go on top, for you being able to look at it from a distance, that really hasn't, I have not been able to compare how those two experiences were. I do think that, you know, looking at the memorial from the vantage point that you're able to do today, one of the things that you don't get a great sense of, which you might if you were up close, was just, you know, the imperfections in the memorial. So how many different, you know, holes were bored in that then were not, you know, necessarily utilized or used, the different ways that, you know, the eyes of George Washington are maybe further apart than they should be, and all this other stuff that you might be able to get if you can dangle from the from the faces, from the heads, you just can't get from afar, which I think creates this illusion of perfection when really there's a great deal of imperfection in the sculpture itself.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, you know, we mentioned President Trump being, and there's so much history in this book, which I think many of our listeners on In the Moment are familiar with and feel very close to that history. But I also think a lot of people are grappling with this moment and what this monument means in the future, what this mountain means in the future. And that was part of what Kristi Noem, as governor at the time, and Donald Trump as the president, were saying, like, this cannot be removed. There's all this legislation that you're tracking saying, you know, the faces can't be changed. They can't be taken down. There's this 3D model given to the president with his face on the mountain. And there's this constant idea about how what changes, what stays the same, who belongs up there, who was originally intended to be there. Should it be there at all? So it's this big, it's not just going through the historical documents, it's also this grappling with whether or not Mount Rushmore belongs on the mountain, whether or not those carvings belong there. How did you approach that and really listen to different points of view as you struggled with this yourself as a writer?
That's a great question, because it really, I think, if anything, what I hope for a reader, whether they're familiar with the memorial or not, is to sort of come a little bit on a journey with me as I try to suss that out in the book itself. And I think, you know, my big conclusion with regards to Mount Rushmore is I feel very deeply that there should be memorials and monuments in our country that make us feel proud to be American. I think it's great to be able to feel pride in your country, to have places where you can feel that pride. And one of the things I wrestled with was whether that kind of feeling is appropriate in the Black Hills, or because of the very complicated, fraught history of the memorial, because of the you know, the history itself is not that complicated. It mm-hmm. is what I said before, the emotion behind the history mm-hmm. that is so complicated, that whether a memorial like Mount Rushmore should be in the Black Hills. Now, you know, obviously, I think what you saw on July 3rd, 2020 was a complete defense of, in fact, you know, Trump used the words an eternal tribute, that Mount Rushmore will continue to be an eternal tribute. And it really got at what you were saying about how, you know, these memorials and monuments like Mount Rushmore that were built to a certain kind of American history should not be defaced, should not be destroyed. But, you know, and I'm not advocating for Mount Rushmore to be defaced or destroyed. I think what I'm advocating for is for it to be deeply considered and for it to be something that if people are going to go to, that they can get access to the full history of the land, the full history of how it came to be in the Black Hills, and the full history of what it may represent to different people in the United States.
But that's what we're fighting about right now, right? In the national discourse is who owns that history, who gets to write it. What should be removed if a new president comes or a new administration comes? What directives are sent down to federal workers? How did you find the interpretation, for lack of a better word, had really evolved or changed over time? And who were some of the forces behind telling that story?
Well, the big change that happened at Mount Rushmore, and I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with this, but when Gerard Baker came in as the first Native American superintendent of Mount Rushmore in 2004, he really began to expand the sort of histories and stories that were there at the memorial. I mean, certainly before, how he did that was to create a Lakota Heritage Village to the left of the sculpture, to be able to hire more Native American interpreters to tell the stories of their communities and tribes, to welcome Native American cultural performers, to perform hoop dances in the auditorium that is at Mount Rushmore. You know, before Baker, of course, there was a Native American presence. I mean, obviously, Ben Black Elk was there for a number of years. I mean, so many people who visited during the 50s or 60s had their photos taken with him. But it wasn't necessarily presented in a way that encapsulated a deeper history of what the memorial and what the land of the Black Hills were all about. And so, you know, I think in terms of where we are at this moment, you're seeing a real conflict. I mean, President Trump in March signed an executive order that prevented national parks from including information that, quote unquote, disparage Americans. And, you know, Baker's point when I was talking to him a lot over the course of this book was that if you're going to do the interpretation of Mount Rushmore correct, you're going to have to disparage Americans. You're going to have to sort of tell this broader history of what this land was, how it came into American hands, and how the Lakota and how Native Americans feel about it. And so that's something that is a real friction point. And, you know, when I was researching and reporting this book, the videos at Mount Rushmore, sort of the introductory films you would see at the visitor center or the ones that you would see on certain evenings at Mount Rushmore, really hadn't changed in decades. And they have changed now. I have not seen them yet. I'm actually eager to go check them out. And I think that they present a much more complicated perspective than what was there before. But, you know, when I first started this project in 2022, 2021, the videos that I were watching were the videos that were put in there before 9/11. The World Trade Center was still up on the videos. There was nothing that was presenting, you know, the Native American story. And I do think that is changing, and that's how it should be. And if we can't do that because of, you know, federal edicts or whatnot, I think that really lessens our ability to make our own decisions about how we should perceive the memorial. If we can't give a full history of the Black Hills, of Mount Rushmore, how it came to be there, how are we going to be able to make our own sort of decisions and judgments and thoughts on how we should feel about the four faces in the Harney Peak granite?
And this is incredibly relevant as we head toward America's 250th birthday. It's incredibly important as the president looks at funding for the National Endowment for the Humanities and talks about a National Garden of American Heroes. Tell me what comes up for you when you see things like, hey, what happens next 4th of July? Should fireworks return? What happens with a new sculpture garden and that funding as the proposals are out? Now that you've laid the groundwork, how are you looking at the things that are coming up just this year and next year?
Well, it is so interesting, isn't it, Lori, that on July 3rd, 2020, when Trump spoke at Rushmore, that's when he first gave the idea of the National Garden of Heroes. Mm-hmm. And now it is, now that he's back in office, it's something that he really wants to create. And of course, you know, there has been speculation about that garden being in the Black Hills themselves, close by to Mount Rushmore. I wrote an op-ed about, I think it was in The Hill, that said that that would be a bad idea. I think there's already enough presidents and enough people in the Black Hills, or certainly we don't need to have a National Garden of Heroes there. But, you know, I think for the 250th, Mount Rushmore will play a big role. I think there's already a lot of firework planning that they're doing to sort of shoot off fireworks again in 2025 or 2026 for America 250. I think there's real hope that the president will come and have another celebration at Mount Rushmore. And, you know, I think it will... One of my fears is that Mount Rushmore will continue to be limited to sort of an icon of President Trump's America, unless something that has potential to be there for all Americans. And I know that, you know, having written this book, the idea of Mount Rushmore being that for all Americans is in and of itself kind of controversial, because not everyone feels that way. But I think if you do present Rushmore in a certain way, if you do be honest with its history, with its past, if you allow it to sort of stand for all the different kinds of complications that have gone throughout American history, you have an opportunity to do that. And certainly, from my experience of listening to President Trump on July 3rd, 2020, and what his initial year or so in office has been like so far, there's no intention in his administration to embrace those contradictions and complications, which I think lessens the potential for the memorial.
This is a lot of things, but it is also, maybe you could argue, first and foremost, a piece of public art. And I wonder, when you look at it like that, when you look at it like art, it brings up all the conversations that you would want art to bring up. And yet, how that art is interpreted and who else gets to make art in the space, and the sacredness of the mountains is also all part of this conversation of what is art and what is public art and what does it mean for us? Did you find people, when you were interviewing them, responded to it as an art piece or only as a statue, a memorial, a sculpture of presidents? Like, does it ever stand alone as public art in the imagination?
That's a great question. I think for some people it does. The people I have spoken to, it ranges a great deal. So I think one of the most common reactions to it actually is how small it seems to people when they first see it, after having it lived on in their imaginations for so long. And I think that has a lot to do with just the grandeur and the beauty and the majesty of the Black Hills that they kind of...
What's around it, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. But there are... I mean, I had one of the great parts of being able to write this book was to stand with the artist laureate of South Dakota, Dale Lampier, and have him give me his interpretation and perspective of the actual art of the piece, which was wonderful to engage in that kind of conversation with him. And then there are people that, you know, cannot at all see the art itself, but just see what it stands for, right? Mm. And for some people, it stands for white supremacy. For some people, it stands for the real, you know, beauty of patriotism for the country. For other people, it stands for a remarkable political achievement that we have achieved for 250 years as a democracy. And so, like, I do think in that way, the art kind of gets subsumed by what it has come to mean. But, you know, I do think that there's a great deal of, if you can put that away for a bit and just look at, you know, these four portraits of these four presidents, it is, and just thinking about how they were able to do that at the time in the 1930s when this was predominantly built, I mean, it's just a remarkable feat of engineering more than anything else, and a remarkable feat of artistic ambition by Gunson Borglum.
So you talk with Dale Lampier, who is our artist laureate. You talk with Marty Tuples Jr., who is artist laureate of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. How did those two artists respond to the mountain in similar or different ways?
Well, Marty and I never really talked a whole lot about the actual art of Mount Rushmore. I talked a lot more with Dale. Marty was very generous in creating a map for the book at the front of the book where he situates Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills. But, you know, Dale, one of the things that Dale continuously brought up to me in several conversations was just the way that, Borglum clearly was a great artist, a classically trained artist, from the standpoint of you could see the different ways that he was able to identify bone structure, for example, or mm-hmm. sort of the muscles behind the skin or the tendons that would really, you know, shape a face. And that's something that if I had not had that conversation with him, there's no way I would have been thinking about that. And, you know, it was also, I mean, Dale was one of the people that has been able to be on top of the mountain and be on top of the memorial and really, you know, get it, because he was recreating it for the 50th anniversary. And so, like, you know, from his perspective, and I say this in the book, he, one of the things that was so fascinating to me about, well, two things were that he said. One was that, you know, the portraits of Lincoln and Roosevelt seem to be a bit more detailed, in part because of the photographs that existed of these two men and the mm-hmm. way that Borglum himself had sculpted Lincoln a lot. Whereas, you know, what you were left with Jefferson and Washington, in many instances, were just the painted portraits of their faces, and people were sitting for portraiture in different ways back when they were alive. Yeah. But the other thing that he mentioned too, which was interesting, is that, you know, Washington and Jefferson were the first two faces to be carved. And so there was a process of learning that clearly took place where, you know, the kind of mistakes that maybe existed on Washington and on Jefferson are not there on Lincoln and on Roosevelt. And I think that's a testament to you know, how we all sort of learn through doing, right? Whether it's knitting or carving a mountain, we tend to get better at it the more we do it.
You mentioned white supremacy, and I've been reading a lot about the Republican Party wrestling with white supremacy, anti-Semitism. What should be done about that? How prevalent is it in young people? Email exchanges going here and there. We talk about Guts and Borglum. Does Mount Rushmore have a white supremacy problem because of him?
Well, Borglum certainly doesn't help his cause. I mean, he was, as many of you know, I mean, before he got to Mount Rushmore, he was the original sculptor of the Confederate Stone Mountain Memorial just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And he had very deep relationships with the Ku Klux Klan. And that is something that is, as far as I know, unless they've included it in the new videos, has been omitted from Mount Rushmore as a fact. And, you know, I've not seen any evidence that he was a member of the Klan, that he was officially joined or donned a robe, but he was very close with Klan leadership, wrote numerous letters to Klan leadership, and was really instrumental in introducing a lot of leaders to national politicians. He ultimately had a falling out with the Klan, a financial dispute that led him to flee Stone Mountain mm-hmm. in the middle of the night and flee into North Carolina. And that was in early 1925. And, you know, months later, he's on top of Mount Rushmore dedicating it for the first time on October 1st, 1925. And, you know, I think one of the letters that surprised me that I discovered through my archival research was there was a Ku Klux Klan leader that was situated in Rapid City. And he wrote Borglum when Borglum started to come out here to do the project. And he wrote him, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't say it verbatim, but basically, we're glad you're here. You know, we like your plan. Would you think about including, you know, Leif Erikson on the mountain as well to sort of, you know, talk about how, you know, the Nordic stock founded this country in many ways. And so, you know, there's not a whole lot of evidence I've found that Borglum kept in touch with the Klan when he was carving Mount Rushmore. But certainly, you know, Borglum himself was very anti-Semitic. He was very anti-immigrant. And so those elements of his personality, his politics, certainly came to the front when he was carving Mount Rushmore. Now, you know, whether Rushmore today has a white supremacy problem, that's so hard to answer, Laurie, because I think Mount Rushmore has a very complicated meaning problem, meaning that it's got a lot of layers of it, and that is one layer of it, but I'm not going to say that is the dominant layer of it, because I know many people who are not white supremacists in any way that take a great deal of value and meaning from Mount Rushmore. So just to sort of pigeonhole them as being white supremacist for wanting to like Mount Rushmore, I don't think that's fair to them.
Was there a moment in writing this book, as we wrap up here, that you were finding yourself inspired as American or as embracing ideals of democracy because of this research and because of the presence of the mountain in ways that you hadn't been before?
There were two that I had. One was when I was witnessing the lighting ceremony one evening in, I think it was May, Memorial Day. And, you know, that the power of the national anthem, of America the Beautiful, of veterans coming there and sort of honoring them and sort of looking at, you know, the real positives of the United States in terms of what we have achieved as a country. I got emotional in that way. And then the second time was I went with my father to a naturalization ceremony at Mount Rushmore on Flag Day 1 year. And that was, for me, both the most moving ceremony that I had seen at the memorial and also a way forward. I thought about how we could potentially embrace the memorial as a place for all Americans and not just specific Americans. I mean, there was a great deal of acknowledgement given to the fraught history of the Black Hills, but there was also a great deal of acknowledgement that 200 people from over almost 50 countries still wanted to come to this country for all that it offers. And it was a real sort of, you know, positive juxtaposition in terms of you can hold all these different ideas at once and still feel proud to be an American.
We've been talking with Matthew Davis. His book is called A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. It's available now. That's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.